This is the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm Amy Guida, Legal Issues in the News commentator, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. This is the last Friday of October, our monthly look at a legal topic. Today, a red-hot issue in the law, or should I say a red-hots issue, not law and religion, not law and politics, but law and food. With me today is Barry Levinson, who calls himself a recovering lawyer. He's written a book published by the University of Wisconsin Press called Habeas Codfish, Reflections on Food and the Law. Hello, Mr. Levinson.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Good to have you here. We'll talk a little bit about food and the law in a serious and not so serious way. And you're welcome to call in with questions or comments. The number is 333-9455 from Champaign-Urbana. Or from anywhere else, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. Mr. Levinson, what is a recovering lawyer?
Well, I practiced law for 15 years before doing what I do now. I'm now in the food business, I guess you could say. I'm the curator of the Mount Horeb Mustard Museum in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, where we have the largest collection of mustards and mustard-related memorabilia on display.
And you are certainly extremely proud of that, are you?
I am very proud of it. Mm-hmm. I am indeed. But I was an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin, where I was head of the Criminal Appeals Division. My job was to keep the bad guys behind bars by writing briefs and arguing cases before whatever court appeal might take me. It could be Wisconsin Supreme Court. It could be federal court for federal habeas corpus. You know, I always want to say habeas codfish now, since that's the name of the book.
Right.
Or even the United States Supreme Court.
Yes, you argued a case there.
I did. I argued a Fourth Amendment case. And as far as I know, it is the only case argued by someone who had a jar of mustard in his pocket.
Yes, tell us about that. You left your hotel room, and what was laying there?
Well, what happened, this was about a year after I started collecting mustards. And by the way, tomorrow will be the 15th anniversary of the mustard collection starting.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you. And on the way over to the Supreme Court, I had to rush over in order to check in with the marshal and be ready for the argument. I saw a little jar of Dickinson Stone ground mustard on a discarded room service tray at the Hyatt in Washington. And it was one I did not have in the collection. At the time, I had a couple of hundred mustards, not what we have now, over 3,700. But it was still one that needed to be part of my collection. And, of course, it was an ethical dilemma. Is it theft to take an unopened jar of mustard from a discarded room service tray? I didn't have time to research it thoroughly. So I did, I think, what every good lawyer would have done. I looked to my left, I looked to my right, saw that no one was watching me, and I took it, and I had it in my left pants pocket as I argued that case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
A good luck charm.
It was, and I did win the case by a 5-4 majority. And some people say, well, it must have been just brilliant advocacy. Other people say, well, your cause was just. And I say, no. It was because I finally brought some mustard to the court. And when you think of it, it really was appropriate because that was the court that gave us Felix Frankfurter and Warren Burger. So finally the mustard arrived.
Good points. What is your book all about then?
The book is about all kinds of topics involving food and the law, everything from the McDonald's hot coffee case to food in prison to food safety issues. Some of it is done in a lighthearted manner because I suspect the courts, when they get food cases, finally take a little deep breath and say, this is something I can relate to. This is something I can understand. This is something that's not really boring.
And that's sort of what happened to you, right, when you came up with this idea of a food and the law book.
Exactly. I had been working at the time at the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, and that's the agency that regulates utilities and just about everything else that moves within the confines of the Badger State. And it's very boring kind of stuff. You know, utility law is pretty tedious. And I totally by accident stumbled onto a case involving the Oklahoma Utility Commission from 1924, back when they regulated the railroads. And the issue had to do with whether the Fred Harvey House at the railroad station could legally require men to wear jackets and ties in the dining room. And it's just a wonderful case, and I've reprinted a chunk of it in the book, where a judge took that as an opportunity to expound on the pleasures of fine dining. I said, boy, why can't I get cases like this? And I took it upon myself to start researching and just gathering materials about food in the law. And there are so many different topics. First Amendment in food, food as a weapon, trademark issues involving food.
Okay, food as a weapon. Give us an example.
Well, you know, on a small scale, I suppose it was a kind of terrorist act when a man, I believe it was in New Hampshire, spiked an omelet that was being ordered at some fast food restaurant, and he spiked it with hot sauce to apparently just, it wasn't clear if it was just to play a trick, but the person who ordered it was a state trooper. And this was a guy who apparently wanted to do some harm to the state trooper. And he did get caught, and he was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. Mm. And, you know, what that shows is that food can be used as a weapon. Now, in some cases, they're very silly and lighthearted. I found a case where a man was charged with assault with a dangerous weapon for beating up his girlfriend with a tuna fish. It was a 10-pound tuna he got at a fish market and used it to beat up someone. There was an individual who broke into a woman's apartment and beat her with a salami, you know, kind of giving new meaning to the term hard salami, I guess.
Wow.
But these things happen. And people are now asking me, well, what does this have to do with food safety today? And, of course, we're looking at food safety in a totally different way.
Mm-hmm.
What I focused on in the book, which was, of course, written and printed before September 11th, were the thousands of cases of food poisoning that were coming on the scene. About 5,000 people a year die from food-related illnesses.
And you write in the book that you became aware of this yourself when you went back to an old restaurant and tried to order a hamburger the way you used to have it there, and you couldn't.
Right. I grew up in New England where we had Friendly's, Friendly ice cream shops that had the best big beef. They're called big beefs. They were square, and my dad just taught me to eat them rare, and I loved them, just bloody red rare, you know, with a slice of raw onion. And it was, in my mind, just the best hamburger ever. And when I went back a few years ago, and of course that was back in the 60s when I remember them, I went back and Friendly's were still there. And I brought my son. I said, you're going to try the best hamburger ever. And I said, I want a rare big beef. And they said, sorry, we don't serve our hamburgers rare. It's medium well done or not at all. And they said, we're doing it to protect you. Well, are they doing it to protect me or to protect themselves from the threat of lawsuits? Because, admittedly, there is a greater danger from salmonella when you have rare beef. But also it comes from the fact that where is this beef being processed? It's not being chopped locally. It's not being chopped on the premises. It comes from far away. They're frozen patties. And there is a greater risk of foodborne illness, specifically salmonella, but you know, there could be other things, from meat that's, especially ground meat, that's not cooked beyond, say, medium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a heartbreaking thing. Now, it doesn't mean you can't get a good rare hamburger somewhere, but you're not going to get one from a corporate chain restaurant.
Yeah, sign a waiver, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, even I said I'd sign a waiver. They just looked at me funny, and they said, no, this is the only way we do it. Now, there are some small places. For example, taverns in the state of Wisconsin are notorious for having great hamburgers. And there's one just down the block from the Mustard Museum that has great, rare hamburgers. And I asked the proprietor, I said, Lori, aren't you afraid of being sued if someone gets sick? And her response was, why is anyone going to sue me? I don't have any money. And she has a very good point, you know, when you think about it. So, you know, those are issues of food safety that are always there. Problems with oysters. Oysters, gosh, if you could study oysters extensively, you could write the definitive book. If you were to study one food at all, oysters, because there have been cases of people being injured by pearls in canned oysters or in oyster soup, pieces of shell, but also because when you eat raw oysters, you may well be at risk from foodborne illness.
Boy, as a lawyer, you read these cases. I'm a lawyer, too, as you know.
Right.
And you read these cases, it makes you really scared, doesn't it?
It does. And as a result, one thing I've not been doing, I haven't given up rare hamburgers. I guess it's a fact of realization that food is risk. Whenever you eat something, there's a risk involved. You have no idea, unless you've grown it yourself, made it yourself. And even there, you can't be 100% certain. But there are certain risks. One thing I've not done since working on the book is have raw oysters.
Mm.
And I used to love raw oysters. I just haven't had them since. There's just because of so many cases of people, especially those with compromised immune systems, raw oysters can be just deadly.
Let me remind people of the telephone numbers. Please join in our discussion on food and the law, 333-WILL in the Champaign-Urbana area, and 1-800-222-WILL. I enjoyed Chapter 3 in your book called Nutrition Facts, Nutrition Fictions,
mm-hmm.
Thou Shalt Not Commit Adulteration. What do you mean by that?
Well, Chapter 3, Nutrition Facts, Nutrition Fictions, is really all about what's been going on with food labeling.
Mm-hmm.
And food labeling, of course, has been a hot-button issue for years, although the nutrition facts that we find on most every product is really a relatively recent chapter in our history. Food labeling and the concerns over what we say about food on the label is about 100 years old. That was really the basis of the original Food Safety Act back in 1906. There was very little that was done in terms of safety. I think the theory was that if people know what's in the food that they are eating, they'll be able to make informed choices and they will be safe.
Mm-hmm.
That law had great limitations. And even though people believed that they were being protected by this new food safety law, which, by the way, was quite new in the U.S., England, for example, had food safety legislation on the books at least 50 years before. There were huge limitations, and the early pioneers of food safety regulation in this country recognized that and worked very hard for new legislation that came about in the 1930s. But it was still based on labeling. If we require manufacturers to truthfully tell us what is and is not inside the can or the jar, that somehow we're going to be safe or at least safer.
We have a caller on line one. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you for bringing up Friendly's and raw hamburgers from New England. I grew up in Mystic, Connecticut, and I haven't had one since we left, but it's one of my best memories from growing up.
And I bet you probably had, when you had it, you also had something called an awful, awful.
Yes.
Which
okay,
was,
what is
in a sense, could be well the subject of a chapter. Because they had to change the name. They had actually stolen the name from someone. And
it was,
that was another food law issue. If you go back now, it's called a fribble.
Oh, no. No, I still remember it as an awful awful. We would walk to the shop and have it with a raw onion on top of the burger and then an awful awful afterward.
And what is an awful awful?
Well, back then in New England, it's called a frap. Here it would be called, a shake.
Shake.
Yeah, only it's not like any shake you could get from a chain.
No, not at all.
Okay, well, thanks very much for bringing up a great memory.
Okay, you're welcome.
Other things, your book brings up something called bread spread, spelled BREDSPRED,
right.
A strawberry concoction.
Right, and this was from, about the late 1920s, early 1930s. There was a case called United States versus 10 cases, more or less, of bread spread. It was a strawberry-flavored gelled substance that had strawberries. It was like strawberry jelly, and the question was this adulterated? And the problem with bread spread was that it wasn't jam. It was a jam imposter because jam is supposed to be about 50% fruit and 50% sugar. And this was something like 17%. The problem was that the government had to show that it was a damaged or inferior food product. And the difficulty was, why was it damaged? What was inferior? It wasn't inferior to jam. It was just different from jam. As a result, it was deceptive. I think is what you could say about it, but that was the problem with the old law. You had something that allowed companies to produce something called bread spread, and the early zealots, I suppose, or pioneers of food safety, were just so upset with this that they said, we have to go after that because that's hurting the public. Well, it wasn't hurting the public. It may have been deceiving the public, but that makes us think about the things we buy. Sometimes, you know, what are the things you want in your food? You want it to taste good, and that's probably, when you think about it, maybe the least important, you know, if on the scale of things. But you'd like it to be honest, you'd like it to be nutritious, and at the very bottom, you want it to be non-lethal. You don't want, you know, even if it isn't nutritious, even if it's deceptively labeled, even if it doesn't taste so good, if it doesn't kill you, at least that's something. And
the problem with
deception, and there's a lot of deception that goes on with food labeling. One of the things I bring out in the book is one of my pet peeves, homemade ice cream.
Yes.
Now, I love homemade ice cream. I think it's great if it's really homemade ice cream. But go to a supermarket. You will see things that are labeled and described as homemade ice cream. Now, come on. You know that if it's in the supermarket, it's not homemade.
And so,
and when
Mr.
you look
Levinson,
at the ingredients, you know it's not homemade when you see, you know, glycerin and guar gum and all these other additives. But they are allowed, apparently, to get away with it because I think the theory is that no reasonable person would really believe it's homemade. It's just kind of fluff advertising.
And you actually wrote a letter complaining about this.
I did.
Did you get any action?
When you write letters to food companies complaining about their products, and especially if you claim it's deceptive, they will usually write back to you and send you coupons for more of the product. And they said, oh, we didn't really mean that it's homemade. We really didn't mean that. You know, we just mean it's homemade taste, and nobody's going to believe that. But then you also get problems with the phrase all natural. And that's something that we're just starting to come to grips with as to what legally can be said.
Sure, we need a legal definition for these words.
Well, you know, I think something that was terribly deceptive was an ice cream company that had all-natural vanilla ice cream. And when you look at the ingredients, you find all these chemicals. And I wrote to them. I called them and said, excuse me, this is all-natural vanilla ice cream. Their first response was, all natural doesn't mean anything. And I said, no, you can't get away with that. And then they called me back and said, we misspoke. What we meant to say was that the phrase all natural modifies the word vanilla, not ice cream.
Very clever. Little maneuvering.
Very clever, indeed.
Line one.
Oh, hello. I'm sure you know that the whole labeling thing, you probably don't want to get into it here, but the whole genetically modified biotech angle, you could have discussions for weeks surrounding that and how big corporations are lobbying just vehemently and furiously against any kind of labeling of the GMO products because that they know that consumers will probably be averse to buying them if it says this is genetically modified or something. But you can talk about that if you like, but my question was, as far as sort of false advertising or misleading things, I've heard of several, and I don't know if they're just legends, urban legends, or if they actually happened in the case with fast food chains, specifically McDonald's, I think. I remember when I was a kid, they went from saying milkshake to shake because somebody apparently pointed out that there was no milk in their shakes. It was like an oil base. And also, I thought for a while there, they had to go back to saying, instead of saying 100% beef because there was so much soy product, and they had to say made from 100% beef, which just implied that there was some pure beef in it, but that it wasn't 100% pure beef. And I was just wondering if you could speak to some of those issues, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, number one, let me address the question of GMOs. I do cover it briefly in the book, and there it's a question of the public right to know. On the one hand, and then I suppose you could say, on the other hand, you have the so-called danger of people being misled and confused by incomplete information. Sure, a lot of the large companies don't want to see that on the labels, and I think their view is that that's something that's misunderstood, it's kind of a red flag, and that people are not really going to understand it. I think, though, that that's the same issue that the nutrition facts opponents brought up 10, 12 years ago when nutrition facts were mandated. So I don't think it's a very strong argument. I think that with respect to GMOs and with respect to what's organic, I think a lot of education is needed, and both sides are going to have to come together and put their information out and then let the chips fall where they may. As for the other things in terms of all beef, as to what's misleading and what's not misleading, there is a series of lawsuits pending now against McDonald's involving their French fries, because their advertising campaign several years ago was, all vegetable or, now cooked in 100% vegetable oil. I think that led people to believe that they were getting a vegetarian French fry, something that a pure vegetarian, a vegan, could easily eat. What they didn't say is that after a year of experimenting with just French fries and vegetable oil, they decided the taste wasn't what it had been, because it had been cooked in lard or beef fat, and there was this very special taste to them. What they did is to go back and add beef flavoring in kind of a spray, but they didn't tell anybody. And there's a lawsuit, or several lawsuits, going on now suggesting that this is really inappropriate and illegal and deceptive for McDonald's to say this, to embark on a campaign that's going to have people who are expecting to all 100% vegetarian fare to actually be a potato that's got some meat essence or whatever on it. The suit is being brought by Hindus, vegetarian Hindus. Be interesting to see how that suit plays out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly, large companies are going to be much more, I think, sensitive to this kind of issue, because it doesn't take a whole lot for bad press to cause great harm to a large company.
Mm-hmm. Let's move now to cases involving foreign substances and objects in food. You write about those cases. There's a great case involving two boys and some applesauce.
For the love of applesauce. what happens, and Amy, you know this, that when legal cases get in the press, what the press covers are the sensational cases. The press isn't interested about a boring case that's, say, dismissed and nothing happens. But when you get a case that just seems, on the surface, just to be zany, and I think this is it. It was a 1968 Michigan case, Martell versus Duffy Mott. And, of course, we're talking about Mott's applesauce. Mrs. Martell gave her two boys some applesauce, and the 10-year-old took some and said, Mom, I think this tastes funny. And the other one, didn't like it either, and she smelled it, and she said, this doesn't taste right. And she brought them to the hospital, and they pumped their stomachs. And there were no long-lasting side effects.
But someone must pay.
Someone must pay. And one of the things that the lawsuit alleged was damages because these boys lost their taste for applesauce.
And how much is that worth in the law?
Well, that's hard to say, because initially the court threw it out and said, that's silly. But the Court of Appeal said, if that's really true, we're going to let a jury decide it. And we're not going to say as a matter of law that you can't recover for loss of enjoyment of applesauce. We're not going to create such a narrow rule. We're going to let a jury decide. If a jury is convinced that a true loss was suffered and that some dollar amount is appropriate, fine. There are safeguards. And I think the most reasonable one is the fact that judges can overturn verdicts if they seem excessive.
And do you know what happened in that case? Did they then settle?
I believe it got settled.
Yeah.
And that's what happened, by the way, to the McDonald's hot coffee case that mm-hmm. made a big splash. Everybody remembers the McDonald's mm-hmm. hot coffee case. Stella Liebeck was the plaintiff. She was, I think, about 80 years old. She got some hot coffee in the drive-up, put it between her legs, and just temporarily, and apparently it spilled. It was not the case that she was driving away. The car was stopped. But she did sue, And initially, the jury said, this is ridiculous. You know, we're not going to even listen to this. I suppose we have to. But boy, by the end of the trial, they were furious at McDonald's. I think what McDonald's did was just botch the defense of the case. They had witnesses say things that really didn't come out the way they should have been. And the jury wanted to award millions and millions of dollars. And I think their award was for several million. And that's what got reported by the press. What didn't get reported was that the judge, who was himself admittedly a very conservative judge, he said, you know, I don't see anything wrong with awarding these damages, but I will reduce it because I think the damages were excessive. Ultimately, the case was settled for an undisclosed amount out of court after the appeal. But, you know, the whole thing about tort reform, when you think about it, tort reform is a response to the jury system. It's somehow people saying we can't trust the jury system to come up with fair and reasonable awards. And even when they do come up with awards that may be a little high, we don't trust the judges that are empowered to reduce their awards if they seem excessive. It's kind of almost an anti-democratic approach, a knee-jerk reaction, you know, to these cases. You know, what's wrong with our jury system? Do we really mistrust it? So I think that's an interesting point to raise.
And we have a caller on line one. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I had to call back when you brought up the McDonald's case because I was waiting for that to come up. The sad thing is that that's held up as a need for tort reform in some of the other cases. I think the one that I remember is one guy put his kid on a ceiling fan, turned it on, launched the child who hurt himself, and then sued the company of the ceiling fan because it didn't say in the instructions that he shouldn't do that. And I think it's just ridiculous. You know, you put hot coffee in your lap and spill it, that's not the fault of the company. So, I mean, it's just crazy that things like that. I mean, but we don't need tort reform just for cases like that. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
We do need tort reform, however, or at least tort cases to be out there for people who find very revolting objects in their food. And can you tell me in your research then what is the most disgusting foreign object in food case you found?
Well, probably the most disgusting one, and I'm not sure if you would qualify it as food. It is something that people would put in their mouth. And that was a 1918 Mississippi case. And it was a guy by the name of Pillars. And he was a fan of chewing tobacco. You know, and I don't think that's really food, although you chew it. So, we'll not quibble. Let's call it food. Because he was quite the bright guy. He took the first plug. I guess that's what you call it, a plug. And he bit into it, and the first one was fine. Then the second one, he said, you know, something isn't right. And he started to get a little ill. So he took another one, and he got sicker. And with the next chew, he bit into something hard. And upon closer inspection, he discovered a human toe with skin and nail intact.
Oof.
That was, it was a toe. And believe it or not, and this is no pun intended, he suffered from ptomaine poisoning. And he did. He tried suing. And now back then, this was 1918, he couldn't win in the trial court because he didn't sue the right people. For some reason, he didn't sue the person who sold it to him. And back then, you had the doctrine of privity. Yeah. Luckily, the Mississippi Supreme Court was enlightened and said, yeah, we're going to let you sue the manufacturer because you might be able to show negligence. And I think their line from the case is brilliant. They said, we can imagine no reason why, with ordinary care, human toes could not be left out of chewing tobacco. And if toes are found in chewing tobacco, it seems to us that somebody has been very careless.
Any idea where it came from in your exhaustive research?
Oh, I don't even want to go there. I don't want to go there.
My favorite chapter in your book is on food in prison.
Oh, What? Cruel and unusual condiments.
Yeah, things called Nutriloaf, for example.
Right, and I have a recipe for that
in there as well.
I was able to get the recipe for the original Nutriloaf. You know, what do you do when someone is put into solitary confinement, or segregation as it's usually called? what's generally done in many institutions is that they are given something called a special management diet, which they call Nutriloaf in the courts. What it is, think of meatloaf without the meat or with very little meat. The recipe that I have, and this came from the Arizona Department of Corrections, has got milk, flour, an egg, potato, carrot, cabbage, celery, beans, tomato puree. It's got all these things and a little bit of ground beef. And all I can say is this is food that's fit for a prisoner. And you would have that three times a day. That was part of the punishment. There's been a change in the thinking of using food as punishment in prisons today. And I think the theory, and I agree with it, I think wholeheartedly, is that prisoners certainly shouldn't be given filet mignon every day. There's no reason to spoil them and give them great food. But give them food that's adequate, nutritious, reasonably tasty, or at least food that's not going to create a riot. You know, there are so many things about prisons that aren't great. And there are a lot of reasons prisoners might want to riot. There's no reason for food to be one of them. And I think that was one of the lessons of Attica. It was one of the things they had on the agenda that they rioted against was bad food. There's no reason for really bad food. Now, I had to find out if this is really true. So I went to a couple of prisons. Just on day visits, I didn't commit a crime to get admitted there. And I had some food at the federal prison and also in a state prison to see what it's like. I can tell you it's certainly nutritious because there are nutritionists on staff now in every prison, or at least in the Department of Corrections that run them. And they are very conscious of adequate nutrition. As for flavor, there's certainly a lot of carbs. It's not great. At the federal prison in Oxford, Wisconsin, Dan Rostenkowski spent some time there. One thing I found there the prisoners seemed to like was they had an all-you-can-eat salad bar.
Amazing.
Yeah, you know, it was okay. Now, what they had for the main course that day was baked chicken, which was very dry, with pasta, spaghetti, with chunky sauce. The chunks in the sauce were potatoes. And it was very bland and just not very good. They did have great homemade bread. The reason why they have homemade bread is because it's cheap. They have the labor, and it's very cheap to make the bread. It's the smell of the bread in the morning coming out is great. It's really good whole wheat bread that they make there. So I you know, it was adequate food.
Did you sit with the inmates?
Yes.
And what did they say about their prison food?
They were actually, a lot of them, first of all, I was in the minimum security wing. Although the food is the same, it comes out to both places. And they said, you know, it's not that bad. One inmate, it was a guy who was up on some white-collar crimes, said, you know, I've lost 10 pounds since I got here. And he said, I had been overweight, and this is good because I really like salad, and I wasn't eating as much salad at home. And he was thrilled. He thought it was okay. They said it's a little boring. Some things they like, some they don't. But they were generally pleased. In the state institution, it's a little different group of inmates. I was at a medium security institution in the Fox Valley in Wisconsin, a lot of sex offenders and a lot of repeat offenders there. And there was a very highly ethnic smattering there, and they were very upset that they couldn't get some of the ethnic foods that they grew up with. Mm. And I asked them all, what are you going to have the day you get out? And, you know, there was one guy who said, I'm just going to have a big steak. One guy said, I'm going back to Mama's. I want her to make tacos the way she makes them at home. Mm-hmm. The big complaint was the food wasn't spicy enough.
But they did love something called breakfast loaf, and so that you included in your
book
as well.
Yeah, that they liked. You know, they would do something that was kind of like some of the food there was actually quite good. And one of the things that surprised me at that institution was I walked in and I saw they had cheese blintzes. That wasn't for the general population. There was a culinary arts program. Because after all, you've got people who are going to be getting out. And if you could get them a job in the food industry, at least it's giving them an edge. And there was an instructor from the Fox Valley Technical Institute teaching them how to make real food. And that day they had a breakfast in honor of some of the GED graduates, the diploma equivalency. And they had a little banquet for them, and they made some cheese blintzes. They had some ice carvings, just like a regular culinary school, except for one thing. They kind of pay attention to the knives a little more closely. You know, and if a knife is missing, the whole place goes into lockdown.
Your book also gets into intellectual property
and
food, The Tale of Mr. Peanut.
Yeah, now you've seen the book, and what do you think? We have a picture of Mr. Peanut. I think it's on page 109. And then this other little humanized peanut, Exhibit B, and the question is, would people be confused by seeing them and think that, oh, this is the same company? Was Exhibit B, the newcomer, infringing on Mr. Peanut's trademark?
What do you think in looking at the two of them?
I don't think I see differences more, and I'm more convinced by the dissent. You know, dissenting opinions are sometimes easier to write because you can appeal more to logic. And I think, yeah, it's a question of, you know, do you see the glass half empty or half full? Each is a symbol in the form of a little man based on an unshelled two-kernel peanut. Each one is standing, and each one is holding something. Now, then there are differences. One is kind of a dapper guy. He's tall. The other one is kind of a dumpy little guy with a crown on his head and holding some kind of a, looks like a scepter.
Scepter.
Where Mr. Peanut is, you know, looks like a dapper fellow with a top hat and a cane. You know, that's a hard one to say. But I think what the court decided was, I guess in the U.S. there's only room for one humanized peanut, and it's Mr. Peanut. That's it. So there are a lot of cases involving trademark issues in food. Sometimes more money is spent on protecting trademarks than on improving the quality of the food, because it's big business.
And yet you point out in your book that someone can steal a recipe for macaroni and cheese from a buffet restaurant, start their own buffet restaurant, and survive a lawsuit, yes?
Right. See, recipes are different. Recipes are more in the way of inventions, but they're not inventions, so you can't really trademark a recipe because it's just a formula. It's just a basic formula. And of course, that has to be so. If you look at all the cookbooks, let's say you want to look for a brownie recipe, how many variations are there going to be? Especially if you're looking at basic cookbooks, because the recipe for brownies is pretty standard, and no one can say, you know, I'm the only one who can have this. As a result, if you do put a recipe, just a listing of ingredients can't be protected. The prose that you put with it, in connection with it, is different. And if you have a photo of the dish, that's different. And sometimes, you know, to protect themselves, or if they're not sure, you tweak a recipe just a little bit. You may increase some insignificant ingredient by a small amount, in which case you can say it's different. You probably don't have to do that. You can say inspired by, we found this, you know, this recipe, you know, in a book or so and so. But it's almost impossible to get intellectual property for a recipe. There may be some issues that come up with so-called signature dishes from restaurants. And that's kind of an interesting issue that I speak to in there. I mean, that's
but not macaroni and cheese.
Probably not macaroni and cheese. I don't think you could say that. Yeah, there are some interesting cases of people saying, "Hey, you stole my idea." Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, you can't steal an idea. And that's really what macaroni and cheese is. It's a simple formula, and courts just aren't about to say that that's something subject to intellectual property protection, at least in that form. Now, I have to warn everyone, this isn't legal advice, so don't go out and copy recipes from a whole bunch of books and say, hey, I heard this guy on the radio said it was okay to do it, and I'm going to sell it on my own. You know, I guess you probably know that legal advice that you hear on the radio isn't worth the paper it's printed on.
On that note, let's move on to restaurant critics.
Ooh, that, you know, that's the first chapter I actually wrote for the book.
Yeah, the Have a Lunch case from West Virginia.
You know, we now get into food and free speech, and the chapter is titled Ladle and Slander. And this is an early case, 1973, a reporter for the student paper at West Virginia University decided to review the restaurant scene in Morgantown. She went to a place called the Have a Lunch, and she wrote, "Have a Lunch, bring a can of Raid if you plan to eat here, and paint your neck red. Looks like a truck stop. You'll regret everything you eat here, especially the BLTs. Pretty damning stuff. And she was sued, and the jury slapped her with $15,000 in punitive damages. Zero in general damages, because Havelange couldn't prove it was really hurt. But the jury said, no, we're going to give you major punitive damages. But the victory didn't last long, because the West Virginia Supreme Court said, you know, doctrine of fair comment, this is something that people can do. You can review movies, you can review the opera, you can review Broadway shows, and in the same way, you can review a restaurant. If you say bad things about it, you are protected. And in that chapter, there's some pretty amazing things.
Yeah, like what other one comes to mind?
Oh, there was a New Orleans place. Reviewer suggested that the poached trout under crawfish sauce would better be named trout a la green plague, and that the duck should have been yellow death on duck. And they sued there, and of course they lost. Mm-hmm. There have been all kinds of cases of people trying to sue, and they just don't succeed. It just doesn't happen. That's what the First Amendment is all about. Doesn't mean that restaurant critics are always responsible, and they do wield enormous power, more so probably than a movie critic. Because let's face it, if you have read about a restaurant and it's said something really damning about it, mm-hmm. are you going to go spend, say, $50 or $60 there and trust your taste buds? You know, you're probably saying, I don't know about that. Got a really bad review. You know, because it's a more of an investment than just a movie.
Did you ever worry about your own liability when you printed these things?
No, not mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. I mean, in terms of writing a book, I don't think I've got, there's not an issue there. Besides, they're going to sue the University of Wisconsin Press.
Right. Yeah, the deep pocket, as we say.
That's right. That's not going to go for me. I don't have any money.
So having done this book, what would you say now is your favorite food other than mustard?
Oh, gosh. Having done the book and for a food of something other than mustard, I mean, I've got... See, I don't eat it, but can you have a favorite food and still not like to eat it?
Oh, sure.
I think it would have to be Spam. Because Spam is the only food that ever prevented a crime that I could find. It was in Denison, Texas, when a would-be robber came into a convenience store and said, "This is a stick-up." And the clerk was standing next to a display of Spam cans and started pelting him with these cans of Spam. And he didn't know what to do, what was going on. He turned around and just ran away. So, I think certainly Spam is heroic. If maybe it might be questionable in terms of great food, but I'm still kind of partial towards it. It's a fun one.
And unfortunately, on that note, Mr. Levinson, we've run out of time. Barry Levinson has been our guest for this month's edition of The Law and You. He's the author of Habeas Codfish, Reflections on Food and the Law, published by the University of Wisconsin Press, as he said. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. And people can call us at 1-800-GET-MUSTARD to order a copy or go online at mustardmuseum.com.
And it is a fun book.